Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning. Welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Radio Indigenous Radio Service, or if you're listening on the web 989fm.com.au or on the podcast a little bit later. Welcome to you as well. It's great to have your company here this morning. A bit rainy in Brisbane, but I think we need the rain. We haven't had it for a while, actually. I was trying to think the last time we had rain. I think it was on the weekend and this week. So it's a nice change, I think. Now, today, a little bit of a different subject for Let's Talk, profiling a young success story. So Catherine Potter is a Kamilaroi woman, has been working in healthcare for about 10 years, started with an Indigenous cadetship, and later became a physiotherapist. She's now the designer of an innovative new device, the Therabubble, which she sort of designed after working for a very long time in the field of Indigenous respiratory health. And she's come on the program today to actually talk about, you know, the statistics around respiratory health and what she's done to try and make it a little bit easier for our mob out there who are suffering with some of these diseases. And she's actually joined with a Aboriginal artist to actually design this device. So I'll let her describe it a little bit more. I spoke to her recently. Here's my chat with Catherine Potter, and I'll be back afterwards to talk about a few other things making news in Aboriginal affairs. But for now, here's Catherine Potter. And today my guest is Katie Potter. How are you this morning?
I'm good, thank you, Amy. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. Thanks so much for agreeing to be on the show. I first wanted to ask you a little bit about yourself. Where's your country and who's your mob?
So I'm a Kamilaroi woman. Most of my family that I am familiar with are living in Benalbo at the moment, but the area, the country was more around Tenterfield area. I didn't know a lot of my history until I was a teenager, and some of my family looked into our history a little bit more, so and we were able to reconnect with a lot of our mob, which was wonderful. So I got to learn more stories and meet more family as I grew older and older.
And you've got a big family down there, I can imagine, around that sort of area.
Yes, I'm told it's a very big area, so I'm sure I'll continue to meet more people.
So I was interested, you said you found out when you were a teenager. Is that what sort of prompted you into this area of where you are now?
I think it's a tricky thing. Like, as I speak to some of my cousins and things like that, and I talk to them a bit about my spirituality and things, and he says, you know, it's the Indigenous blood, it's in you, and this is why you feel like this. And I think I realised, like, I had that connection. Yeah. So I think it really helped me to find a bit more sense of myself, knowing my history a little bit more. And so just as I matured as well, you know, I was very interested in learning more about my Indigenous culture. And then through my studies, I obviously, we do learn about Indigenous health as well. And then now I'm sort of at the time in my life where I'm able to start to give back to communities. And it's something that when I was younger, I thought, you know, I always want that opportunity now to be able to give back because of all the things that have been provided to me, whether that's just education or storytelling or being able to do studies and things like that. I feel like now it's my time to connect back. I've developed this respiratory device, and I think that that was just the ultimate platform for me then to fulfill that part of my desire, I think.
Yeah, it's a really noble goal, I guess. But when you started, your studies, I guess. I mean, how would you explain to your listeners? You've been in healthcare for about 10 years, mm-hmm. but you work specifically as a physiotherapist. What does that actually involve?
Yes. So as a physiotherapist, there are many different areas that you can work in. So when I first went into physiotherapy, I thought I was going to work in sports and look after people with sports injury. Now I can't think of anything more boring.
I think that's why a lot of people enter it, actually.
Yes, that's right. And then when you start learning the different fields that you can be in, it just really opens your eyes. So I really liked working with people. I really like the science of the body. I think it's an amazing mechanical device, amazing machine is probably what I'm trying to say. And so some of the areas that I particularly lean towards is more the respiratory work. Men's and women's health is something that I do advanced work in. And as I've been through my time in the healthcare, I've also really loved rehabilitation. So at the moment, I do work in the advanced area for men's and women's health, but obviously having this business as well helps me to fulfill some of the enjoyment I get from doing the respiratory type of physiotherapy too.
And respiratory health, we talk a lot about, you know, the gap in the difference between health in Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, but we don't really drill down into the different sort of reasons behind that. But respiratory health is a leading cause of death, isn't it? Can you explain a little bit about what are the diseases involved with Indigenous respiratory health?
So a lot of the problems will be with two main groups. So the elderly group, particularly with people who have been smokers, so long-term smokers, might end up with problems with COPD, which is a chronic disease problem with the lungs, and emphysema fits under that umbrella, and bronchiectasis as well. So it's problems where people get a lot of breakdown in their lungs. Their lungs become floppy. It's very hard for them to move secretions out of their chest, and very hard for them to get good ventilation because they get a bit of air trapping. And so often that can be caused by a long-term history of smoking in terms of how that's related to the Indigenous population. So smoking rates are obviously very high in the Indigenous population, but that is something that the Close the Gap campaign has been finding, that there has been progress towards cutting down those smoking rates, which is excellent. Then you have diseases like asthma, which can just, you know, affect anybody, and also the bronchiectasis can happen from young ages, and they can be spurred when there's poor health conditions, things like overcrowding, so lots of diseases just continuing to be spread between people, so thinking of the housing conditions as well. And just poor hygiene cares. So just being very vulnerable to repeated infections, which can lead to some of these respiratory issues. And then they also look at the mothers and who are having babies. And sometimes the mothers who are smoking can cause development issues with their babies. So the baby's lungs aren't developing well, and then can be having issues with respiratory problems as well as they're growing up. And so that's why the Indigenous population is a little bit more prone to these respiratory diseases. But I think that the Close the Gap campaign and the reports, it's showing that there is improvements being made, which is fantastic. And I think particularly the target of reducing smoking rates, which is excellent.
But a lot of this, I mean, you mentioned sort of overcrowding and a lot of those issues. So a lot of these problems lead into, you know, poverty, I guess, and poverty issues amongst our mob, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. And so I think, you know, there's a lot more that needs to continue to be done. And I guess it's bit by bit, isn't it? And, you know, working on little parts here and there to help to improve the living standards, education, all of that to help these people, help Indigenous people with their having the best quality of life they can and long life as well.
It's really, it's a leading cause of death, isn't it? I think there was a study recently looking at New South Wales, Queensland, West Australia, South Australia and the Northern Territory, and respiratory disease made up about 8% of those deaths for Indigenous Australians between the years of 2008 and 2012. Mm. So that's a lot of deaths. That obviously bleeds into the low life expectancy. That's a major part of that, is it?
Yes. So I think the cardiovascular diseases are the highest cause for death, and then respiratory is definitely one of the ones on the list. And so I think if there's any ways that we can help people to improve their lung function, that's fantastic. And like you said, just to increase their life expectancy, but also quality of life as well.
It must have been interesting because you obviously studied, you're saying you studied Indigenous health at university. I guess it's very different when you actually get into your practice and go back to your community, or you work with a lot of blackfellas. Very different in practical terms, I guess, from what you're learning at university, did you find?
Yeah. So I didn't do any specific subjects of Indigenous health in physiotherapy, but as part of the core subjects, they did provide subjects on this area, so I didn't do any extensive studies, but yes, when you do go out and see, work with the communities and visit the communities, I think it is because it's just so multifaceted that it is very tricky, and as a physio, when I volunteered on Palm Island, it's just sort of getting the message out there, just being flexible to talk to people when they're wanting help, and just doing what you can.
So when did you start to get the idea to do this? I think it's called a Therabubble.
When
did you can you describe why you decided you wanted to start that?
Yeah, sure. So when I was a student, so about 10 years ago, I was doing my first pracs, and the actual technology for the PEP devices has been well known for many decades. But honestly, all we used to do is use a makeshift device. So it's like a do-it-yourself device where you grabbed a bottle, you grab some tubing from the hospital, and you put it together. And honestly, we were using things like milk bottles. And
so what is it used for to help breathe? Is it?
Yeah, sort of devices? It's so you may remember a little bit earlier I talked about people who have some of the respiratory problems where their airways are a bit floppy. So what that means is that the air gets trapped when they're trying to breathe out, so they're not getting all their dirty air out to allow a nice clean breath back in. And then sometimes then all the secretions are sitting down low in the chest and they're not able to get coughed up.
Oh, right.
So people get lots of infections then sitting in their chest, and then they have trouble. So the PEP, which is just means like it's called positive expiratory pressure, but basically by blowing against the water inside the container, it creates a safe pressure inside the lungs that keeps the people's airway open, and then that way they breathe all the air out, all the phlegm can come up with that, and then they can clear their chest and take a nice deep breath of new oxygen in. So it's really good for those people who are having trouble moving that air out and getting those secretions up. And so it works really, really well, but I just remember as a student, I really was embarrassed for the patient giving them a makeshift device. I thought it was almost disrespectful when they're really sick and saying, here, try this. And I remember always trying to tell people, I promise it's really effective. It doesn't look fancy, but, it works well. I felt like it was a bit degrading when they're sick and in hospital that we're just giving them a milk bottle. And so I always thought I'd love to just be able to make a proper medical device based on the same concepts. And so that's what I eventually did. So you can imagine as a student, and when you sort of move into your first few years, you're just trying to consolidate information and lots of learning along the way. And then I guess I got to a point where, I was quite relaxed about what I was doing. And then I approached my colleague from university and I let her know about the idea. So we co-founded the Therabubble. And we just made sort of some new features based on the old concepts to make a nice new, as safe as possible device to use in the hospitals. So that's how it came about.
So this is, I guess, Have these sort of devices been used before, or this is sort of a first that you've
This is actually
across?
The first one that's been patented in Australia.
Wow, that's
awesome. And as far as we're aware, overseas as well. The makeshift devices, they don't meet the Australian regulation for medical goods. So you're not allowed to, in Australia, provide medical devices that aren't on the register for the therapeutic goods. And one of the rules of being on that register is that you can't put things together that weren't intended to be for that purpose.
Oh,
so
right. Which makes sense.
Bottle,
yeah.
So grabbing a milk bottle and grabbing some ventilator tubing does not constitute that to be a medical device.
So but people were still doing that, were they? They
exactly.
were still offering that.
And unfortunately, it still happens. So I think as more people are aware that there's actually policies that govern this in Australia, because we've got, you know, some of the best standards in the world, they will start to realise, and the Therabubble, I guess, meets that void as well, which is fantastic, so that they can continue to use that type of therapy, because it's such an affordable way and effective way for therapy for people. And they don't have to be in the hospital either. It can be for the home as well.
So it just really makes things a lot easier to breathe, I guess, these devices help out with.
Yeah, that's right. So we say just for breathing easier, and the main things that it's registered for is to clear the secretions and improve ventilation. So getting, you know, as much oxygen into the body as possible.
And so you've patented this already. What's been the response, I guess, from medical quarters, I guess?
Yeah, it's been excellent. So initially it was a little bit of a transition when they were used to using makeshift devices, but then eventually hospital policymakers realised that this practice wasn't appropriate. And so when they started letting the staff know that you shouldn't really be doing this, then staff were looking for the alternatives.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, as it sort of transitioned, it's just a mindset transition, I think, for people. Then they know how to use the therapy, which is fantastic. So it's an easy shift over for them. And we wanted to make sure that we kept it really affordable, because otherwise it would be very hard for people, and they might not then choose to have that as a technique that they can use if it was too expensive to purchase.
Yeah, right.
So one of our goals is to keep it as affordable as possible, because it's such an easy thing to prescribe for people.
And you recently, in NAIDOC Week, you actually collaborated with an Aboriginal artist, didn't you?
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Because it's really great. It seems like it's going to help a lot of people, not just blackfellas, but obviously started with from a blackfella point of view.
Yes. So, like I mentioned earlier too, just having this business now really gave me that platform to be able to start to give back to community. And so as NAIDOC Week was coming up, it was a little bit of a sort of thought work in progress, but I had, prior to that, I had contacted a company called SOS Health, who provide volunteer physiotherapy around Australia. And so quite a few months before NAIDOC Week, I had actually contacted them and said, you know, this is who I am. I'd just like to donate some of these devices, you know, as I mentioned, just giving back where I can. And is there any particular groups that you would recommend I provide them to? And they said that there were some kids on Palm Island that might really benefit. So that's when I first sort of had that contact. So I donated a bunch to Palm Island back then. And then it just sort of got me thinking, oh, you know, I can do a lot more now. And so I thought, how wonderful would it be if we actually used, because, you know, the NAIDOC sort of information was coming out and it was all about storylines and things like that. And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fantastic to actually put some artwork on the Therabubble, so that, one, it's like a celebratory thing, so that any Indigenous or non-Indigenous Australian who sees the device can actually have some awareness of NAIDOC Week and what it means. But then also, particularly for the Indigenous people, if they see the device with the artwork, they might be less shy to participate in their therapy as well. And so just be able to engage in their therapy a little bit more. So that was the intent for doing that work. And so I contacted one of my cousins and I asked him if he knew of anybody who might help me out with doing some artwork. So he put me on to River Binge, who designed the Goanna, which was the totem for the Benalbo area. Part of the design was connecting people together and looking after each other. So I thought that was really lovely. So we put that on there and I donated as many as I could around different parts of Australia, but also was just selling them as normal as well, so that any of the clients who were normally buying them, like I said, also then had some awareness of NAIDOC Week or might be then interested in reading more about what NAIDOC Week was. And we put some little flyers, little cards in each one to explain what the artwork was about, and again just to raise that awareness of Indigenous culture as well. So as a celebration, as well as helping with the health, you know, closing the gap in the healthcare as well.
You mentioned you obviously have a close association with Palm Island, and you're talking about giving them out to kids there. I mean, it's quite concerning, isn't it, that a lot of our kids have got these real respiratory problems?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's heartbreaking almost, you know, that it's through no fault of their own. But the bubble PEP, which is basically what the Therabubble is, it's quite fun to use. So when they blow into it, it's creating bubbles, and so they don't actually feel like they're doing...
They're looking at bubbles.
Yeah, they're not doing any therapy, you know, the doctor's making them do this. So it can be quite fun and easy for them. But yes, it is about help them managing their conditions, because they have to keep their chest clear and do it for maintenance. Otherwise, they can, you know, get infections really easily.
So what are you hoping? Oh, definitely. And what are you hoping to for this to come to? You're hoping to for it obviously to grow and more Therabubbles to get around Australia?
Yes, yes. Yes, I do hope that all the rest of the states in Australia sort of are able to change their mindset and use the Therabubble in terms of a registered medical device. And it does have some extra safety features on it as well, to reduce the risks for use compared to the old makeshift devices. So it's much safer for people to be using. But it does require a health professional to prescribe it, so that all the risks can be reduced as much as possible. So hopefully around Australia, and then and that way I can keep working, I guess, with my personal goals as well, to, you know, contribute as much as I can back to Indigenous health and spreading the word as well.
I think it's a really great thing, because it's come from you, a Kamilaroi woman, and it's targeted specifically to helping blackfellas with respiratory disease a little bit more, I guess. And
yeah,
where can, if people are listening, I guess, where can they sort of look into getting this or going to doctors who may recommend it if they want to
look
more into it?
So we are internet-based for retail purposes. So just on the website, it's www.therabubble.com.au, and on there is a section where you can purchase directly. You can use the PayPal or credit card, so it's nice and easy, and the contact details are there. So you're welcome to contact us if you're having any trouble with using the internet, so you can ring and we can arrange payments over the phone as well. And all you need to do is just go and speak to your GP, or if you have a physio or a nurse that you can speak to make sure, firstly, just make sure that it's the right device for you. And then if they believe that that's a good thing for you to use, then you can jump on the website and buy that, and they'll teach you how to use it.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time this morning, Katie. I really appreciate it.
And no worries, Amy. I really appreciate it as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You're listening to Let's Talk, and my guest today was Katie Potter. We're talking about sort of her device that she's developed 10 years working in Indigenous health as a physiotherapist. So a good little success story right there. Someone who's working within their community to help make it better. Like so many other of our young mob all around the country, some great stories out there as well. We might go for a break. Stick with me. I'll be back after the song.
You're listening to Let's Talk with Amy McQuire on 98.9 FM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk. My guest this morning was Katie Potter. We were talking about respiratory health, Aboriginal respiratory health. Now, the song I just played, Kanaka Blues, I actually just found it in our folder. Really nice song, but the reason I played it is because tomorrow is the Australian South Sea Islander Recognition Day. So South Sea Islanders got their recognition from Queensland, I think tomorrow in 2000. So quite a while now they've had recognition. And if you're driving along the Story Bridge earlier this week, I think it was on Monday, you would have seen it lit up in the colours of the South Sea Islander flag. So we've had a running series on Let's Talk called The Forgotten Queenslanders, talking about that other black history throughout Queensland. And obviously a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities have a lot of South Sea heritage as well. So it's important to acknowledge that and to mark the day tomorrow. So wherever you are, tomorrow is Australian South Sea Islander Recognition Day. And if you don't know too much about it, I really encourage a lot of you to go out there and find out a bit more, particularly if you're in Queensland. South Sea Islanders all over Queensland, but also just learn a bit more about your history, because obviously the labour force made up of black labour, largely slave labour, of Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islanders and South Sea Islanders built the state of Queensland before the White Australia policy actually come in. Equal pay, blah, 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 and then they sort of forced black labour off, and what happened after is quite very sad, particularly what happened to South Sea Islanders. We had Professor Clive Moore on, I think it was last month, who is one of the preeminent historians looking back into South Sea Islander history, and he was talking about the fact that, you know, we all talk about what happened in the early days, the kidnapping, the forced labour, the contracts that were signed, when obviously a lot of islanders wouldn't have an idea of the terms and conditions. So you could argue, you know, what were they didn't actually know what they were signing into. When the British talk about indentured labourers being different from slavery, I still consider it a slave trade. But he was talking about the fact that following the emergence of the White Australia policy, the fact that there was no help for South Sea Islanders, the ones who actually stayed here. So they were pushed to the margins, had a lot of trouble actually surviving on the fringes of society. So it's a very different black history, but also an essential one to understand. I'll be back after the break.
You're listening to Let's Talk with Amy McQuire on 98.9 FM.
My guest today on Let's Talk was Camilla Roy woman named Katie Potter. If you want to catch up on that chat earlier, you might have missed it earlier in the show, you want to catch up, that'll be on 98.9fm.com.au on our podcast section. You can also check us out on Facebook, Let's Talk 98.9, or check us out on Twitter. Leave us your comments there. It's always appreciated. Now, isn't it amazing that we're Aboriginal affairs really does run in cycles, doesn't it? Now the Australian are talking about the fact almost $6 billion is spent every year on Aboriginal affairs with very little evidence, very little, you know, data explaining what's working and what's not, very little evaluation. Now, I don't know where they get a lot of their viewpoints from, but I guess it can only be from the fact not many of them hang around a lot of blackfellas on the day. But they've used this report from the right-wing think tank Centre for Independent Studies to claim this in their editorial. Some 65% of Indigenous people have jobs and lives similar to other Australians. The obvious question is whether Indigenous-specific spending on this sector amounts to middle-class welfare. They claim the neediest sector was those dependent on welfare and living on Indigenous land, where work and education opportunities are scarce. They reckon this profile represents only 13% of Indigenous Australia, or 70,000 people. I mean, it's quite a shallow summing up of the wide variety and forms of disadvantage throughout Aboriginal Australia. It's not just in remote Australia, it's in urban, regional Australia as well. And sort of using this data, which I might add isn't very independent for a Centre for Independent Studies, it's very conservative as well, And they've used this to sort of talk about, you know, another assault on welfare. I think that's where the sort of the vein of the editorial seems to go. I mean, can we just have an honest and appropriate conversation based on evidence? Has the welfare reforms which have been rolled out across the country actually worked? Is there a lot of evidence to support, particularly the compulsory income management scheme in the Northern Territory, in WA, the trials up in WA, the fact that they're rolling out the 100% healthy welfare card? I mean, there's very little evidence to suggest that putting tighter controls on welfare actually helps or works. In fact, the international evidence is pointing to the contrary, and the fact is that we need a proper welfare safety net. We need some form of universal basic income, because obviously it's not going to work to just rip the welfare safety net out from a lot of communities that have no other prospect of building an economy. I mean, they're basically trying to put really draconian and punitive measures on people when there's nothing else in place, unless you count the community development program, the CDP, which is draconian again, and which, if you want to catch up on a lot of the well-founded criticism around the CDP, check out my interviews with John Altman. Yesterday we spoke to John Altman about CDP, but there's also a big archive in our podcast library as well, talking about CDP with him, and also other interested parties, people in the welfare sector as well. It's a lot more complicated than just claiming, you know, welfare dependency obviously is a big problem, but it's a lot more complicated than that, I think, and a lot more complicated than the picture the Australian wants to paint. But, you know, we can't be quite shocked. It's sort of the same old from them, isn't it? Thanks for joining me today on Let's Talk. We spoke to Katie Potter earlier in the show. You can catch up on that podcast at 989fm.com.au. We'll also put up the details of what we're talking about in relation to the Therabubble up there. And also spoke a little bit about the war on welfare being waged. Obviously, we're in this environment where that's the current paradigm, the current narrative that's being promoted. And we'll obviously have more on that in the future, just like we always like to analyse a lot of what is happening in Aboriginal affairs. Now, before that, we also spoke about the fact that tomorrow is Australian South Sea Islander Recognition Day. So an important one to recognise and relearn a lot of our black history that's been deliberately kept from us, that hasn't been well covered in the history syllabuses around the country. Not many people know that Australia also not only had the slave trade of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, but also South Sea Islanders. So that's tomorrow. Tomorrow, I'm talking to Troy Cassidaly because he has a book out, an autobiography. So that'll be quite exciting to be able to chat to him in depth about his life and his new autobiography that's out. So that'll be quite exciting. He'll be joining me here in the studio. Thanks for joining me.